Hello, and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Tan Chao Han. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, hello. Hello, John. I'm really happy to be here. I'm glad to be able to join you today on this podcast with everyone.
Yeah, no, this is great. You know, I don't think I've interviewed anybody that's been in such a far different time zone than myself.
Yeah. Thanks for making the time zone leap with me.
Yeah, no, it was great. Thanks for being accommodating. So Xiao is a Singaporean tabletop RPG designer whose freelance work for Paizo Second Edition includes contributions to the Bestiary 3, Secrets of Magic, and Pathfinder Adventure Path 167, Ready, Fight. He also creates tabletop RPGs and puzzle games with his company, Curious Chimeras, as well as produces freelance material for other games, including Ark, Blades in the Dark, and Monster Care Squad. So, Xiao, can you talk a little bit about your journey to becoming a freelance author and game developer? You have quite an interesting story, I think, that's a lot different than most of the folks I've interviewed.
All right. Okay. So I guess like for my trajectory, actually, I've always had a strong interest in tabletop role-playing games. It's been like my, since I was a kid. So, you know, like the kind of like, you play D&D, you play a lot of like, I play a lot of second edition D&D and third edition D&D. And that's where I kind of like got interested in Pathfinder first edition, because it was kind of like the other flavor of D&D. And I also had a lot of dungeon magazines, and that was where, like, right. I think, like, right. Paizo's first generation of staff were from, right? So the adventure paths, everything inside there. So I've always thought to myself, a lot of magazines, like, oh, you know, it'd be cool if I got my things up there. But that was so long ago, and I think really where my path to become a freelance author now began was, I think, with the internet, and I think I listened to your podcast interview with Ruviot a while ago, and it's a similar thing. It's a, I saw a post on Twitter for Paizo. I think it was Liz who sent out something about wanting diversity authors, about BIPOC authors, and me being somebody who's really out of, like, I guess, the American cultural sphere, I thought, all right, yes. I saw the Twitter, I thought maybe I'll give it a try, and I sent in my CV. And they said, sure, we'll let you to write for us. And that was how I got involved with Paizo. Before that, I've been doing other freelance things as well, but that's mostly because of the insight here in Southeast Asia. There's a lot of independent role-playing game creators. And so it's a lot more like, I guess it's like a scene where everybody has a band, right? And then, like, you know, when you're not doing your own music, you're helping someone else being their bassist. And so I have a lot of freelance work for a lot of friends' projects, and a lot of us have been involved in more of the indie, sometimes the OSR or story game scene. But Paizo is pretty much, like, I guess, the first AAA kind of like RPG project I've been involved. So this whole journey of, like, me going to writing, I think also echoing something off Rovai, it's like, you know, it's not the main job, but it's definitely a very fulfilling kind of side profession. How I started onto this was really by just seeing something on Twitter. I don't even use Twitter that much. And then I follow up on it. And next thing I knew, I had all these interesting work opportunities.
Wow, that's cool. So yeah, Ruvade was the person I interviewed just 2 weeks ago. So it's interesting that you have that follow-up. So, you know, you're the first person that I have met who's living in Singapore and plays Pathfinder. Though, you know, we have a venture lieutenant here in Seattle that's from Singapore, and she's actually a five glyph GM. Wow. And working towards her, I think she's almost at her fourth Nova for Starfinder. So I'm really curious. You mentioned that a lot of folks are playing games there. So are tabletop RPGs in particular very popular there?
Yeah, I think like tabletop role-playing games are rather popular. I think to kind of like in the Southeast Asian market, it's becoming more and more popular for role-playing games. And of course, there's that recent surge in popularity because of all the actual play podcasts that are like glamorous ones. But even before that, there's always been, like, for example, game stores where I walk past as a kid, I'll be like, oh my God, look at all those miniatures, look at all those cool stuff. I wish I could go into them. And pretty much, I guess, the big three in here were you will see people selling Pathfinder products, D&D merchandise, and Games Workshop stuff. And so pretty much it was this like, hi, people always think that, okay, this is a bit like Warhammer, except you have to talk in funny voices. Yeah, but yeah. It's pretty much also linked, because here in Singapore, land is a very small country. So mm-hmm. land is pretty scarce, houses are pretty small. So having the space to have a big, nice gaming table is kind of mm-hmm. rare. So most of the people who play here, we tend to kind of like either play in game stores or at a friend's place, but that was before the pandemic. Now everyone just plays on the internet. I think mm-hmm. TRPGs are definitely very popular here, and I've met a few Pathfinder fans here. I don't play PFS much, but I know quite a few people in the PFS, and definitely there's a lot of organized play seems to have pretty much been a shot in the arm for many people's games, because you can just drop and get in and go out, play a longer path if you want to. I started PFS with, I think, it was a Wrath of the Righteous game. I think, again, this is similar to Rawfire 2 weeks ago. But, we wanted to go PFS, but I think, the GM said, never mind, they'll just do it as a home campaign. Yeah, so mm-hmm. TRPGs are really quite popular here, and I think it will only get more popular as with the present 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there any conventions out there that have a lot of tabletop RPG presence at them?
Okay. So, we have a few, there's a few local regional conventions. So, for me, the big conventions that we have, there's one which is essentially the San Diego and New York Comic Con. So, there's a Singapore branch, they call it the SGCC, the Singapore Comic Con. So, it's also done by Reed's exhibitions. So, they tend to have organized play for D&D there. So, for the past few years, they've been having this big D&D table. So a few years ago, I was helping to organize RPG tables. It's not at the level of, let's say, Gen Con, because it's pretty much more like a common family con. So you have like Marvel comics, you have tabletop games, you have basically lifestyle things. You have maybe people playing video games. But I think the presence of this role-playing games is increasing. There's dedicated role-playing game cons, there are, but they tend to be smaller in scale. It's kind of like maybe we rent a community college hall and you have a day's worth of games. In terms of huge-ass convention centers, most of the time those are mixed cons, mostly pop culture cons with a bit of tabletop thrown in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you say it's growing there, though, so that's kind of exciting. Growing.
Yeah, so it is very exciting.
Yeah, so I know, Paizo has their main Paizo convention in the Seattle area, mm-hmm. and then they kind of have, they do something in the UK. I don't know if Paizo, do they have something in Southeast Asia as well?
It's really funny because most of my invitations to PFS games this is actually from my contacts in the Philippines. The time zone for Singapore and the Philippines is around the same, so I get mm-hmm. every week I'll have would you like to play this? Would you like to play that? I have tons of invitations on my Facebook and on my PFS Facebook. And I also, in Singapore, I think based on my limited experience after, I noticed a lot more home games of PF2 mm-hmm. and a lot of people seem to be still playing, I think, PF1 or Starfinder. That's what is based on my observations. But I think as more material comes out for PF2, you'll find more PF1 people switching. I think the recent one was Secrets of Magic. It's everybody's waiting for Magus, everybody's waiting for, now Guns and Gears, right? Everyone's waiting for Gunslinger. Right. So they can port their beloved first gen concepts over, I guess.
Right. So now, do you get hard copy of the books there, or do you just get PDFs?
I there are copies of the books here, and generally speaking, the good thing about, I guess, being in Singapore is just a little bit of a chatter about supply chain. It's we do get books rather easily. We do get for example, I have friends and business associates in the Australia, New Zealand area who might order things to Singapore, and then they ship over from here to there.
Okay.
Because I think regionally speaking, it's still much easier to get access here because we are kind of close enough to both sides of the Asia Pacific. So we do get the benefit. Yeah, things are not cheap, but they aren't ridiculously expensive, so it's still much more affordable to be able to bring in books as a small business owner. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering because there's been a big delay in a lot of the books going out.
Yeah, it is.
Because they're coming from that side of the Pacific. And I was wondering if it had to come all the way to here and then get shipped to you. And you're saying they can send it direct to you then.
Yeah, it's like I haven't received some of my things. I think I haven't received my Secrets of Magic as well. So I'm just like waiting for, I guess, the River Nile to clear up. It's like, you know, it's like we always have these shipping issues, right? And but yeah, like generally a lot of people, I think in this pandemic, they're also kind of very used to playing with their tablets. And I think mm-hmm. Path Builder has been a right. massive help to a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, I like Path Builder quite a bit. I'm primarily a Starfinder player, and so Path Builder was really great for me to get playing, and then using Foundry because you can import directly in.
Yeah, Foundry.
I wish that they had a Star Builder like that that worked just as well.
Yeah, like I don't play a lot of Starfinder, but I think, but I was very fascinated by the recent MacBook, and I was thinking right. like it'd be so cool if there was like a Star Builder with like, you know, like you can build vehicles, mm-hmm. you can build mechs, and you know, like the Starfinder groups are, it's very fun because the physics changes in the games, right? Like in Pathfinder right. 1, when you charge, you get a bonus to attack, but in Starfinder, if you charge, you get a penalty to attack because you're charging in the automatic gunfire, right? Mm-hmm. It's one of those things which it's really cool, and I think like dedicated builders can allow people to really understand, hey, the same thing does different things in different rules, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, neat. So, you know, I was reading your background a little bit, and you have a master's, and your thesis was on tabletop role-playing games and their ability to engage, empower, and educate. And you've actually been a game designer at the National Institute for Education. Can you talk about this work and this intersection between tabletop RPGs and education that you've been working on?
Okay, all right. So actually, my background is before I my day job is I work in education. I mostly work in do a lot of science and communication education. So I don't do a lot of science, but I teach people who work in science to express themselves more clearly. So, and kind of like, I guess like this academic link has always been present in my work. So before I got here, I was working in this Institute of Education. That's Singapore's governmental authority for kind of how it designs and develops like educational policies. So my work there was for a learning sciences laboratory. So it's a bit of a psychology slash educational studies place. And I worked there on, again, making games for board games and role-playing games for teaching, I guess, science and critical logical thinking. So most of the time when I was there working there, it was a lot less game and a lot more education. So it's kind of like you had that mindset, which was, if we made the lessons more fun, people would enjoy the lessons more. That was the theory they were working with. Mm-hmm. But my own work in research was, I was mostly working on, role-playing games instead to see how they help people visualize and, in a little way, tell a story about themselves that is not displaced by other people's stories. You know, like creating a little narrative that you have like, oh yeah, I'm actually quite heroic. I'm actually quite brave. I'm actually trying my best. It's like we've got a lot of media and a lot of influencers that tell us things like, you are incomplete if you don't have this. You suck if you don't have that. So I really thought that in role-playing games, I observe a lot of heroic arcs of storytelling. And I was quite interested in how to use those things, especially help people generate healthy communities and self-esteem so that they can be motivated to improve themselves. I was mostly working at looking at kids and people who came from not so high-performing backgrounds and seeing whether there was any benefit for them through role-playing games. Yeah, so that was my research. Yeah.
And what kind of findings did you have from that?
The findings are how, I guess it's like, you know, like how, like we're just talking about Path Builder and like a hypothetical Star Builder, right? You know, it's like when we play a game, there's this like, there's this period before you play the game where you dive into the game and you're like, okay, if I buy this feat and I kind of like a spec out for that gear, you know, that little building phase of things, it's like, mm-hmm. I found that to be quite interesting because in a lot of my research, I noticed that people were interested in building characters that they may never play.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, I've done a lot of that.
Yeah, it's like that seems to be as satisfying as anything, you know, like, especially if you are far away from people at the moment, you can't play people easily because of schedules or whatever. But creating a character like that and imagining that, hey, you know, this person would have this background, that story, it kind of like serves as I was kind of observing that as how people ended up using that both for therapeutic purposes, in which like, hey, you know, this is somebody I would really like to play. If only I have a chance to play it, then it's kind of comforting. As far as like, there's a certain continuity to people's character designs. And I just thought that maybe that would be really cool to have games that didn't punish people for imagining themselves, but rather promoted and nurtured them, kind of making their characters in whatever they want to do. I guess this is a lot less spectacular finding now, because nowadays we are a lot more used to playing characters that are not quote-unquote optimized. But I guess back when I did this research, there was like a lot of people who were trying to use these games to prove that they were competent in something. And like, you know, you have people who, oh, I'm not good at math, but then when they're playing role-playing games, they're like saying I'm a math genius. It's like, you know, or like a, yeah. And I just found that shift in identity, that shift in confidence to be quite inspiring, I think. Yeah.
No, that is really cool. It's, you know, it's the kind of thing that I'd be curious if a large company like Paizo or Wizards of the Coast would be interested in sponsoring, showing the positive effects of role-playing games, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I haven't considered the kind of like the corporate interest. Yeah, but definitely it would be a dovetail with their core identities, actually.
Well, I'm doing some research in games and decision-making. So I have a PhD. I mostly do consumer psychology work. Mm. So we might have to team up and work on something here.
Oh, all right, sure. Yeah, please hit me up and let me know.
Yeah. All right. So, Xiao, what type of things does your company publish?
Okay. So, Curious Chimera is like, we are essentially, I think there's two main branches of things we do. The first kind of things that we do is tabletop role-playing games. It's still kind of like in a very, most of the games we've done are free to, either free or very low cost, things that you find mostly on Itch.io rather than DriveThruRPG, I guess. And those kind of role playing games tend to be more tongue in cheek. Like we tend to kind of do more like silly games because we started working mostly with kids, right? So we wanted to make more silly games, but then we also noticed that the kids brought their parents along, so we started making more things that the parents will play the kids, like, hey, this is funny, but the parents are like, wait, there's a little bit of humor to it, a bit of bite to it. Right. That was how it kind of started. But it started shifting towards, I guess, a more Southeast Asian kind of design, I guess. The meaning for that is that my company is very linked to this kind of RPG design movement, or called RPG, hashtag RPG SEA. So it can be found, I guess, on Twitter and other places as well. It's very much like you don't have to be from SEA to be an RPG SEA, but that's why we have a lot of POCs from BIPOCs from all over working with us. But there's this idea that we should honor both our local histories as well as our own basically non-center kind of perspectives is all right to put inside there. So like, there's been a shift in our products. We've started doing a lot of things about some games are a lot more based on, I guess, the kind of portrayals of culture and history and imaginations of fantasy that's more present in, I guess, Asian imaginations than the usual medieval Europe fantasy RPG things. So that's one half of it. The other half of it is we make a lot of experiences. So we design experiences for people. So in this pandemic, we've been doing things with design kind of like AR, alternate reality, augmented reality kind of games to allow people to do virtual tourism. So, for example, the local museums called us up to, hey, could you help us get people to visit our museums even though they're stuck at home? So we went down, we took cameras, like fisheye cameras, we rendered the whole museum into like a virtual dungeon, and then there was like a mystery inside there, so they do puzzle games and stuff. So Like sometimes we work for companies that say, hey, can you do like a special experience for our employees? And then we do something like that for them. So that's two things. We make games that are like kind of traditional role-playing games. And then we make like experiences which are either immersive or puzzle-based or something based on what the client wants. Yeah.
Wow. And and you said this is kind of a new company. Is this something you plan on doing like full-time then? Or is this always... going to be a side thing.
Well, I mean, like, you know, it's like this is a freelancer hustle, right? It's like, essentially, it's like my identity is shifts over so many places, in which, like, my ostensible day job is I work as a lecturer and I teach and I grade student papers that never end. But I write RPGs as myself, and also I write RPGs as part of Curious Cameras, and I design things as part of Curious Cameras. So I kind of wear these many hats. Ostensibly, Curious Cameras is the main thing because I'm kind of like the founder, the co-founder of it. And everything else that I do sort of like is like my own time of sorts. So as a next year in 2022, we do have some cool things lined up, which we're kind of hoping for the confirmations for. But it's a lot of it's a lot more collaborations with maybe either institutes or with museums or libraries to try to get people involved in learning and having fun at the same time. So you can see that whole academic game link is quite strong for the company.
So, Xiao, what advice do you have for people interested in getting into tabletop RPG writing and game design like you've been doing?
I think the big thing I'd like to put forward is that there's a market for everyone. I guess that's the first thing I like to put out, is that because I think for a lot of us RPG people, we might have a lot of imposter syndrome. I'm not so sure whether that's common, but I do notice it a lot of like my friends and colleagues that I feel are deeply and greatly talented, but for myself and them, we always have this, I always notice this trend of, this sucks, does anybody really want to pay for it? And I think again, if we don't put ourselves out there, we wouldn't know. But I'm sure that there's somewhere, someone, there's a cultural need, a cultural gap for something that we are creating. I think for looking over at companies and looking over at job links, starting out freelancing is a great way to start because, like, for example, I learned a lot about publishing and best practices by working with Paizo and having the excellent guidance of the various designers and the lead developers that give me timely feedback. So it was really a kind of a mind-blowing thing. But if I wouldn't have absorbed this knowledge of this corporate culture if I hadn't worked as a freelancer for Paizo. So it's like, I think for people who are, if I'm in my room sitting down thinking about what games I want to make, like the content of the game rules, the game text, and the production aspects, how it gets out there in the world, I think there's a bit of like two different skill sets. So sometimes if you're all stressed out about, does my content work well, it might be good to let someone else take a look, go and get into actual freelancing kind of a job, no matter how well or poorly it pays. Of course, try to get paid fairly. I mean, that's the whole point, right? Get paid fairly. But learn whatever corporate processes and that people have. Then you're like, oh, okay. You mean I can spend 1,000 words on doing this? Then I guess in the future, your own game designs will also flourish better because you know what a book is supposed to look like. You know what a chapter is supposed to look like. Yeah, I think that's my big, not very clear advice, I guess.
No, I think that's a great perspective. That's, you know, I've done a lot of interviews and I'm always curious to hear different people have different takes on things. And I think what you said has been unique from what other people have said. You've contributed quite a bit right there.
Oh, thank you. I hope this will help some person, whether young or old, basically, who is like writing something, a homebrew thing. They think, oh, you know, I need my friends to approve of it because I'm the forever GM. It's like, you know, this is a cool house rule. But, you know, sometimes if it doesn't resonate with your friends, but maybe you could put it out there, it could earn you a few bucks, but more importantly, if someone writes into you, says, hey, you know, I really like the thing you use, it was really balanced and worked really well, then maybe that will keep your design heart sparkling and keep you happy and creatively fulfilled. And I think that's really important.
Great. Well, Shao, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. Really appreciate it.
I'm very happy to be here. It's actually the first RPG podcast I've been on, so I'm very happy to be here on presenting.